In this episode, we discuss the reaction to the death of Hulk Hogan, and also how we can see the evolution of American culture through his public life. Hello, welcome to the Call Like I See It podcast. I'm James Keys, and joining me today is a man who is the realest American that I know. Tunde Ogunlana. Tunde, you ready to show us what you're going to do, man, when the spotlight of the podcast is on you?
Of course, man. That was a great honor. I appreciate that. I'm a great American.
Yes, you are, man. So now, before we get started, if you enjoy the show, I ask that you subscribe, like the show on YouTube or your podcast platform. Doing so really helps the show out. We're recording on July 29th, 2025, and we saw last week that Hulk Hogan passed away, whose real name was Terry Bollea, and he passed away at 71. And as one would expect it for someone in the public eye for so long, we saw many obituaries and reflections on him as a man and his life. Some of these seemed to try to see him and reflect on him in a positive light, while others didn't shy away from discussing or contextualizing the more controversial or even ugly moments in his life. But the through line that we saw through all of this is that a lot of people had a lot of thoughts and had an opinion on this and had stuff that they had, built up over the years on it. So I want to discuss the idea of Hogan, who was, somebody who was not like a world leader or business titan or anything like that, but an entertainer, and how our society, looks at that now in this modern era. But first, I wanted to get to you and, look at Hulk Hogan as unquestionably a man who was very popular in the United States over the last 40 plus years. And so what stands out to you as far as, some of the super high highs and also some of the lows that we've all witnessed?
Yeah, it's a great intro, man, because I think that encapsulates Hulk Hogan's, at least, like you said, the public journey that we've seen him from the outside. I mean, I can't get into his personal head of how he felt about his own life. But for specifically me, I mean, you asked me straight up. So I'm born in 1978. So by the time, let's say, 1985 rolls around, I'm a 7-year-old kid and I'm watching Hulk Hogan, flying off the ropes, and he literally is like a superhero to me.
Yeah.
I think for our generation, he was like what Superman was for kids in the 1950s who were reading comic books.
Yeah. Or a Marvel superhero, like an Iron Man for like a millennial or something like that.
Yeah.
Early.
Just someone you look up to. You don't even understand why you're looking up to this guy, right? Like, meaning you're so young. He was just cool. He was the embodiment of everything that we were taught to believe was good about America. And I think I didn't realize it back then because I was just a kid, and I bought into it with a big smile. And I look back at that fondly, actually. So
yeah.
I know in this conversation, we'll get into some other parts that we feel represent the American culture and what America kind of has become to represent. But at this part of my nostalgia here talking about it, I can think of Hulk Hogan as a very kind of, for me, it was like a lovable figure, like a guy that was a hero that would always get the bad guys and the kind of things that we were indoctrinated to believe that we were as Americans. I think the kind of post-World War II, we beat the Nazis and the Japanese, we saved the world, and we were promoting all this democracy and pluralism around the world. And Hulk Hogan maybe personally didn't embody that, and he wasn't walking around talking that stuff, but the idea that he was in Rocky III, that, he was beating up the Iron Sheik, he was beating up, guys from other parts of the world that we didn't like. So it was this kind of, this macho-ness, of American muscle.
He was sold as like a real life Captain America, so to speak, in that sense that he was, the song, I'm a real American and, all this other stuff. Like that's how he was sold. And so him as a babyface was definitely that. Like to me, the thing that really stands out, the high highs stand out, but also the lows, because what I see the story of Hogan is, what I see in that is how it mirrors our culture and our entertainment evolution over the last 40 plus years. Like Hulk Hogan was kind of the pinnacle or close to it of the monoculture. that existed up until a certain point, because this guy was, again, by any reasonable measure, he wasn't an important person. You know, he wasn't a world leader. He wasn't, you know, some business titan that changed the world with some invention, Steve Jobs or something like that. Like, he was an entertainer, you know, like he participated in, you know, professional wrestling, scripted professional wrestling. And, you know, so he might as well have been a soap opera person, you know, with big muscles and with violence, you know. So, but he's known by everyone, you know, like of a certain age, everybody knows who that is, you know, like, and so he's one of the more popular people in the world. And so that is kind of, again, the pinnacle of monoculture. And then monoculture starts to break apart, you know, and we go into something that, you know, like the reality TV phase. Well, Hulk Hogan was involved in reality TV and doing that stuff. And then we end up now in a place where polarization kind of defines our current modern and both entertainment and cultural, you know, like these two. One of the things we might talk about today is how those two have kind of blended to form really, you know, where the entertainment, the culture has followed the entertainment. But the polarization piece, like now he at current, you know, where he was in the past few years was a polarizing figure. And that's very consistent with the times in the United States right now, where, you know, there aren't many people who are well known and aren't very polarizing, you know. So, and the more well known you are, the more likely it is that you're going to be very polarizing in many respects. So that he went through that whole thing, and you can see that in a high profile person, you know, kind of how our culture developed, devolved, however you want to term it, you know, depending on where what your perspective of it is. But it's reflected in him and how people received and understood him. And also just kind of related to that is how much more about him we got to know beyond the public persona. You know, part of the reason why, like, he's the baby face of the 80s and early 90s, is we don't know much about the guy. We only know what's being curated and presented to us. Whereas, you know, once you get into reality TV and the polarization type eras, then you actually start knowing a lot more about your quote unquote heroes, you know, like, and what they're really about, so to speak. And you can't, or it becomes harder to separate those two and say, okay, well, I like this public persona, even if the private person is not somebody who I would rock with.
Yeah. And you know, to add to that, I would say this, he himself, and like you said, the life that we've watched him live, is like, to me, he's the one human being that kind of personifies America, both the kind of long-term cultural arc of America, as well as the modern, I would say, what some of us feel might be a decline of the American, you know, story that maybe we revered at one point. And so when I say the long arc of the culture, you know, I wrote down a term here, and the term is confidence man, but it's not in the term that is traditionally used, like a con man, like he was conning people or something. What I mean is actual confidence, meaning the idea of a carnival barker, a guy in the 1800s, you know, that's going from town to town, being bold and loud and selling some story, and people just gravitating to that type of individual. And we could think of people that back then, like, you know, P.T. Barnum, just the idea of getting people's attention, being a loud entertainer, and people following that.
Yeah.
And put exactly best way to say it. Thank you. Because you mentioned something earlier, which was he got famous from scripted wrestling. And the term scripted is very important because, unlike Greco-Roman wrestling in the Olympics, let's say, that's not scripted. That is the meritocracy, the best athlete wins, that kind of thing.
The most resourceful, the strongest, or the most, like, all of these, like, competition, real competition. Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying is that, think about this. I mean, I don't know if this, I know that, let's say, this form of wrestling, entertainment wrestling, has spread to other countries. So I know that now in the modern world. But I don't know of another country that founded a type of sport that is 100% scripted. I'm not saying it's never happened, but it seems to be pretty rare. And so it seems like that's part of an American culture, which is, one part is something did happen. The other part is willingly accepting another version of the reality, and or even being aware that the reality is that you're watching is scripted, and being okay with that and being a fan of it and wanting more. So That to me is interesting.
I would say that's less unique than you think, though, because if you think about it, professional wrestling in the United States is basically theater for jocks. You know, because if you can watch the same kinds of themes, you know, like there's good guys and bad guys, there's babyface and heels, kayfabe, you know, like you got to stay in character while you're doing these things. Like really what it is theater, you know, and I mean, that's another thing actually that we can see how that has permeated our current culture is that, you know, part of the leadership style we see that's very successful adopts a lot of the professional wrestling kind of ethos and that approach to getting people emotionally invested in storylines and, you know, hey, these got these enemies that are trying, they're cheating and they're trying to, you know, to thwart me and so forth. And people get behind and become, as opposed to becoming, you know, like we're in a democratic society. So instead of becoming voters and citizens and so forth, people are just fans. And it's like, hey, I'm just a fan of this person. It doesn't matter what they do, you know, like if they do something, then that must mean that I'm down with it because I'm a fan. And so, you know, like I think that, if anything, something was discovered through the explosion of professional wrestling in that this is a way that people like to have stories told to them, you know, and whether it be real stories or fake stories, like this is the people that came up with the soap operas were onto something in terms of, you know, this constant drama and this constant kind of, you know, presentation of that's the lady that you got to watch out for, or that's the guy that is going to save the girl, or this is the girl that'll stab you in the back, all this stuff. Like the soap opera people were onto something, and that's kind of permeated into professional wrestling. Now I can go into politics and so forth. The one thing I wanted to mention real quick before we got off of this part, though, was one other.
I got something for it too, so let's stay on.
One other piece, real quick, though. One other piece that I think it deserves a mention here, because this also to me tracks the 80s, is, you know, the 80s and the mentality of America in the 80s, coming out of the 60s, 70s, you know, then where you had this New Deal mentality, where you had the biggest middle class in the history of the world, where you had one earner households, all that stuff achieved through solidarity amongst the labor class to get a more fair shake of how the spoils of society are going to be shared. Well, in the 80s, that starts to really reverse. And one aspect of that was, or one high profile aspect of that, you know, people point to, oh, you know, there's this union that gets broken by Reagan or anything like that. But there's also in professional wrestling, the wrestlers, as that entertainment form became more prominent, more profitable, people like Jesse Ventura started to try to agitate for better conditions for the wrestlers. And Hulk Hogan, being one of the top guys at that time, actually threw his weight behind management. He sided with management as the lay part of the labor, but a highly paid part of the labor. So he started this schism that you see that we don't even blink at it now, where a lot of times the higher paid labor parts of the labor force side with management, side with the capital and so forth, and are complicit in trying to keep down and there's no solidarity with labor in general to where, hey, all of labor, we should try to get ourselves a better shape. And so, people look up and throw complaints around, oh, Elon Musk, he's about to be a trillionaire in a couple of years, and they're mad about that. And it's like, well, but sitting around being mad about that, like there's a specific reason for this. This stuff isn't happening, you know, because of fortune or, you know, dumb luck. This is because the system has been changed, and many people who used to have solidarity with labor and saying, hey, we want to have a fair shake for everyone, we want people to be able to share in the spoils of society, that agreement is gone. And so now it's like you got people fighting over sustenance, and everybody else is living their best life beyond the means that they could possibly ever, you know, need to have.
Yeah. And I think, look, you're onto something with this goes back why I think Hulk Hogan actually is fascinating representation of the direction of the United States, because we can't blame him
for that necessarily.
Yeah, we can't.
It's more of a reflection.
We can't blame him personally for the demise of unions and things like that. Exactly. But you make a great point, right? He represents as someone who was a star in a certain industry and was the highest paid person. He had an opportunity to go one of two directions. He could either look to the other people that were doing the labor with him and saying, hey, I know you guys are, you know, I'm hearing the chatter about collective bargaining. You know, let me use my position as the biggest star here to help in this endeavor, help all my fellow wrestlers with sharing some of the spoils that is coming from all this new revenue that's coming, because the 1980s was also the explosion in cable TV technology, satellite TV, all these things. So you had all these new lines of revenue, just like with the NBA and NFL and other sports, just technology allowed for that. So he had a choice. And like you said, he chose to side with Vince McMahon and management for whatever reason. But to your point, the 1980s is when a lot of people that were at the top of their respective industries or being paid very well decided that they were going to side with the capital and industry class and not the labor class. And that's just a fact. It's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just an explanation of, like you said, why we're here, where we're on the cusp of having maybe a human being become the first trillionaire, and Americans not understanding what happened.
Right? And then how other Americans live in like they live in a third world country, and they're like, "Well, what? How did this happen?" And it's like, "Well,
yeah."
there's a very serious explanation.
But that's what I'm saying. So that's a good explanation, because that gets me thinking about where we were as a country in the 1980s. Because again, you and I were kids. Ronald Reagan was president. He was a very inspirational president. I mean, I still go back and see some of his speeches now and read them and think, wow, this guy was a great orator. But we know that there was a little bit of rot underneath the system that he was overseeing, right? And there was a lot of dismantling of the things you alluded to, what was prevalent in the New Deal that brought us the largest middle class by the 60s, so on and so forth. And I think part of that was able to be done on the backs of division, divide and conquer by those, and I would say elites, upper class, however you want to call it, the wealthiest folks at the time, saw a lot of what happened in the 1960s as threats to their position. So not just civil rights, but the feminism movement. You got the Vietnam War, the anti-war crowd that disrupted maybe some of the military industrial complex's ability to do things. Then you had things in the 70s, like the malaise of the 70s, the oil embargo, the tough economy, and then also more distrust of the government from things like the Pentagon Papers that end up with the Church Committee hearings, right, about all the assassinations by the CIA and all these things in 1976. So you had this decade, and then here comes this guy named Ronald Reagan talking about mourning in America, and a term that has been used since, which is make America great again. So Hulk Hogan, as someone who looked apart, he's a 6'8" blonde guy, kind of looked like Thor, right? And a lot of Americans, whether they look like him or not, envisioned themselves or a perfect American to look like him. So he came in at the right time from a marketing and a sales kind of point in American culture, where the culture was looking for someone to make them feel good about being American again.
And he was an amazing showman.
I'm going back to
his credit.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, the long arc of American history, showmen have always been present in America, right? Like it's part of the story.
Well,
so
you got
it. It was like a perfect coming together.
We shouldn't minimize that, though, because that's important. You know, like, a lot of times people who have a more kind of intellectual or brainiac understanding of, you know, nations and cultures and tribes and all that kind of stuff focus on, you know, kind of the mechanics of it. But the vibes are very important, and just people feeling good to be a part of something. And so a lot of times you can see, if that stuff is neglected, then even if things are going well, people will feel bad about it because nobody's attending to making them feel good about what's going on or what they're a part of and so forth. And so, and Hogan was that, you know, in that time period.
No, I agree. And the other part, James, that I think for me, and I'll say this, I'll speak for me, you may agree or disagree. Not everyone listening may have the same perspective, because, you know, we all have different lives here. But I would say he's very American for me as a Black American, meaning he's very present in my mind as my own experience with America when I watch him, because of what came out. Because I know, you know, people watching this may have known of some of his ups and downs with the controversial stuff. And one of them was, you know, he was taped being very racist, using the N-word and all this kind of stuff. And so that, to me, also was like, man, this is also a part of being American and a Black American, which is, Hulk Hogan was my hero when I was a kid, literally, when I was elementary school as a kid. And like many of us have with other American heroes or just prominent people in the American culture, as we grow up and get older, sometimes these parts of their character come out, and it's like a disappointing, it's like a letdown. You know, like, I wasn't upset at Hulk Hogan when he used the N-word, I wasn't like,
well, you were an adult at that time, you know, like if that happens when you're a kid, it breaks your heart, you know? So maybe by the time you're an adult, you're kind of used to the fact that your heroes as a kid, depending on where they're from or what kind of America they really buy into, when you had a more simple understanding of the world, those same heroes turn around and make you feel really bad about yourself if you're not careful. So you're probably, as an adult, already hardened to that, you know, like, hey, this, you know, any of these guys at any point, you know, for all I know, now again, not all of them, but any of them could, I could find out something about what John Wayne said, used to say, or what, you know, anybody said, and be like, oh man, you know, that's not what I wanted to hear.
John Wayne's a good example because I grew up watching Westerns and I loved them. And then as I got older and read interviews of what he said about Black people and all that, I realized, man, he looks at us the same way as he looked at the Native Americans as savages. And there's a part of it that's disappointing. And there's a part of it that you're kind of like, and that's how I felt with Hulk Hogan. I was like, when I found out what he had said behind the scenes and his racism, it's just kind of like, there was a part of me that was like, oh man, you too. Like, just disappointed, you know, like not upset, not hurt. Not, it's just kind of like, okay, I get it. And so it's like, that to me is also very American, right? Because just like he said that stuff and people heard it, and it may have hurt, damaged his reputation a bit, but there's also a big part of America that if me and you talk about that, they want us to shut up. Yeah. They just don't want to be told about it. They don't want to hear about it. Oh, shut up. Why do you keep talking about it? He said, well, I'm talking about it because, you know, it's pretty relevant to people like me, but you don't want to hear that. And that's also very American. And that's what I'm saying is like, he's just representative of the whole thing.
That,
and then
that has been reduced to a card. You know, so you know, it's like, okay, you're playing this card. I'm like, oh man, I mean, it's not a joker, it's not an
enemy. You know, it's funny, it's not a winning card. But you know what's funny, James? People with that attitude are the same ones who play the victim card today about ideas like the Great Replacement. Like they you and I aren't allowed to talk about when a hero of ours disappoints us. But they can sit there and you know, talk about everyone that
and always be a victim of other things.
And they're always right. And so that's just, it's just American. That's what I mean. Like, we're not allowed to talk about this stuff. And you and I kind of accept it and put up with it. Not necessarily
I don't know that we accept it and put up with it as much as we just understand that's going to be the background noise that, you know,
correct. Occurs. That's a better way to put it. Yes, so, that's a better way to put it.
It's like, I'm going to go to the bar. And if my wife doesn't like me to go to the bar, there's going to be some background noise when I go to, if I go to the bar, like, all right, well, I'm going to have to hear this. I'll keep moving, you know? So
if I talk about Hulk Hogan in this way, you're right. It's just, I know that they're just going to chatter.
Like, and like, whatever, dude. So
even though he said it and it's on him, he's the victim.
but there's one other thing I wanted to get to in this, you know, and then, but by the way, that was well said. You know, I think that it is definitely something that, from a maturity standpoint, I think your experience though, and the way you reacted to it, as far as how you said is a disappointment, not like that's because of your maturity, because excuse me, at all points, I say that like Black Americans, a lot of times we're forced to confront and deal with that kind of stuff, you know? And so once you do it a couple of times, it's like, okay, okay. So he's one of these guys. So, you know, don't want to invest too much emotion and happiness over there, you know, or don't want to put any, you know, like, so to speak. And so you just know, you know that that's on the
can
table.
Can I say one more thing? No, because his last name's Bolea. I looked it up. His dad's half Italian, half Panamanian. And I just thought of that too, James, that for us Black Americans, it's another example of someone that kind of wouldn't be considered white when I was a kid, because he's not a pure WASP. It's almost like he passed. And by passing, what does he do? He beats up on, you know, he's trying to like distance himself in that way. And that's a thing that we as Black people collectively understand as well, that people immigrate to this country and kind of,
they pass as, you know, considered a lower or underclass, and then they kind of assimilate in and then turn around and say, oh yeah, forget the Blacks, you know, yada, yada, yada. Blacks are the problem. And so, I mean, that's part of it too, but
that's interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to keep us moving. One of the things I wanted to, or where I wanted to close actually, was talking about, you know, I was talking about the monoculture and how popular Hogan really was. I mean, like, again, on one hand, you could probably list the people that are as popular as him, and also had, but he also had such a high approval rate, you know, like at various times, you know, you 80s, 90s, so forth. Like, he's such a highly thought of guy. And it's just rare to see someone who's that popular, who also is that well thought of, across all spectrums of society, or so many spectrums of society. And some of that is because, you know, again, we only knew what we were allowed to know at that time. But it's something that I don't know that we're ever going to see again. But the rarity of it, I would illustrate with Muhammad Ali, you know, in the sense that Muhammad Ali, we all look back. Oh, yeah, Ali is beloved and he's very popular, one of the most popular people in the world. But it's like when he was alive and when he was kicking and when he was talking, he wasn't beloved. You know, he was, you know, disliked by a good chunk, if not a majority of the country. And then, you know, eventually they came around and was like, yes, this is a great man. We love this guy. And then he's universally beloved at the end, you know, and so forth. So, but the question really is can anybody right now, as I said, we went from a monoculture to kind of a reality TV thing where you get to know more behind the curtain about people to now just polarization where it's kind of like everybody's picking a team. You got to be a baby face or you got to heal. I have to view people as a baby face or a heel. I can't just receive information and kind of keep them, you know, put that into my brain, mix it around and then keep it moving. And so the idea of, is it even possible now for someone to be so popular yet not a hero or a villain, you know, but not be polarized in that way? What do you think, man? Do you think that's even possible?
I think with the way information is disseminated and just online and all that, I don't know if it's possible right now. Maybe we'll have some sort of order and some sort of curation of this information landscape at some point in the future. But today, I don't know, because I just think that, yeah, there's enough, you know, Hulk Hogan, along with a lot of other people, Michael Jordan and others we could talk about that were stars of the 1980s, let's say, and 90s. Like you said, the monoculture is something that I think led to that, right? Yeah. Like these men being so liked, the fact we don't have a monoculture and it's more of a fractured culture because of the information networks that we don't all share. Remember, when you and I were kids watching Hulk Hogan, there was another 40 million people watching Hulk Hogan at the same time, right? Yeah. And the population of America might have been 200 million back then. So it's just very rare. I mean, the Super Bowl,
we were watching was selling him as a hero, as the guy to like.
Exactly.
Like, and with a guy on the other side who was exaggeratedly bad, you know, like in a soap opera drama theater kind of way. Like, so it's like, yeah, we all would identify with the hero in the story and be happy when he defeats the villain in the story as it's been curated for us, narrative, you know, created for us.
That's what I was going to say. I think in the year 2025 that we sit here in, I think the Super Bowl might be the last communal kind of cultural thing we do as Americans. And in recent years, that's become an area where culture wars have permeated because of the halftime shows, people complaining all the time about whether they like it or not. And so.
Well, I think people complained about the halftime shows for a long time. Like I remember when Janet Jackson did the halftime show.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'd say this generation, right? Like meaning this last 20, 25 years, people didn't used to complain about the halftime shows in the 90s and 80s.
Well, they might have, but they might not have had the ability to complain and be heard also, though, because that's the other
thing. I'm getting with the information networks. That's why I think that we're at a different time now where one person may not be able to have a 90% approval rating by society just because
I agree.
Voices.
For that reason alone, that the idea of being a contrarian is appealing to a lot of people. And so even if someone's behavior was one that would warrant a 90-95% approval rating, they won't get it because there's going to be too much, it'll be too lucrative to go the other way. You know, for some, there are going to be people who, if you go the other way, that'll be a lane you can carve out. Like carving out a lane. Saying that, LeBron James, great basketball player. Well, I'm going to carve out a lane that LeBron sucks. And I'll be able to get, you know, like a lot of attention on myself.
20% or 30% of people, will accept it. So, but maybe that's the thing, right? Maybe this is the reality and we were living in a fantasy before.
That's exactly what I was going to say,
by 90%.
Yeah, what it really reflects is, I'm sure there were people who, you know, maybe thought it was a little too much or a little too cheesy or, you know, whatever, or like, oh, this is all scripted anyway, so who cares? But it wasn't lucrative to go on the networks at the time or to really take that corner and be the one. That's what you're arguing and that's what you're known for, so to speak. And so I think the appearance of the monoculture, or excuse me, the appearance of a high approval rating was due to two things mainly. One is we didn't get to see behind the curtain, you know, and so we don't know necessarily what's happening. Even with somebody like Michael Jordan, who I would say had a very high approval rating, he would have gotten a lot more criticism if it was known at the time widely his gambling, for example. You know, like that would have been, there would have been people who would have been criticizing that or you know, being skeptical of this and that. And so being behind the curtain a little bit more, and then also, like I said, more voices competing for attention means that every angle of anything is going to be hit. And so if the angle is a contrarian angle, it's going to be hit. So it's just, at this point, we're not set up to all generally like the good guy. I mean, to the extent that, I mean, you've talked about this. I think we both talked about it. To the extent that you got people saying Jesus was too nice, you know, like Jesus was too nice to be a Christian. It's like, okay, yeah, there are no universal good guys anymore. Amongst Christians, Jesus is not seen as a universal good guy, and the way he behaved is not seen as a universal good, then yeah, there is no more, you know, super high approval rating anymore. That's not possible. And then same thing with, you know, the flat earthers or whatever. Like if we can be on this little ball and then in the space and be like, yeah, it's actually flat. If some of us can think that, then yeah, it's there's no more agreeing on some, what we might even consider the basics. So, but yeah, man, I think that ultimately though, it is an opportunity to have a window back and see kind of where we come. And that's not to say that we need to go back there, but that's just, you know, it's interesting to see the evolution, because a lot of times these things happen. And if you never take a step back, you can't get perspective on kind of where you've been, where you are, and also where you may be going. So interestingly enough, you know, this gave us the opportunity for that. So, you know, you and I know there's been a lot of people out there, you know, with negative wishes towards them, people with positive wishes. You and I didn't even want to look at it from that standpoint. Like, we don't want to wish anybody bad, you know, but at the same time, there is something we can look at ourselves from a cultural standpoint from this. So,
yeah,
so we appreciate everybody for joining us on this episode of Call Like I See It. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it, review it, tell us what you think, send it to a friend. Until next time, I'm James Keys.
I'm Tunde Lamana.
All right, we'll talk soon.